Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from up here on the shelf in 2019. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov. You mean the shelf in Andy's room, right? Specifically?
Of course I mean the shelf in Andy's room.
You know, it just seems like, you know, it's a little vague.
This is part two of our Toy Story 2 episode with Griffin Newman. We're going to go ahead and get right back into the discussion.
So let's just breeze through the plot real quick, yeah, because we've hit a bunch of it, but I kind of just wanted to, so the credits at the beginning, your 10-year-old Griffin,
yeah,
the credits start. How are you feeling in this moment? Like, is this just, are you scared or are you just like, I know this is going to fucking slay?
I not to repeat myself, but truly the happiest I've ever felt in my life. I started like from second one feeling a sense of security. I'm very nervous.
But you're a nervous person.
I'm a very nervous person, you know. Sure. But I had faith in them, but it was like there's a lot riding on this, yeah, in terms of my psychological stability for the next couple decades. Right. This movie is really going to be a turnkey in one way or another. But I even just like the boldness of the sort of the credits, Superman parody flying thing, and I was just like, okay, they're going for it. Yeah. Whatever. I don't know what the joke is here. Yeah. Starting in space seemed really weird, you know?
Yeah. It's such a great opening. Buzz just killing it, and just see like the coolest you could imagine Buzz to be.
Yeah,
is how they start this film.
Which I think this movie's relationship to its opening is something that Edgar Wright bases the rest of his career off of. Because I feel like Edgar Wright in his movies now does this trick always where in the opening scene you give the fake version of what's going to happen for the rest of the movie.
That's really
because
funny.
Everything Buzz does the Zurg sequence is mirrored or repeated in some way.
That's really
down to the physicality or the beats of it. You know, his rescue totally mirrors this one-to-one.
That's really interesting.
In the way that, like, you know, World's End, it's like the names of the pubs are the arc of their relationships to each other.
He just telegraphs the whole thing for you.
He telegraphs the whole thing for you.
And Baz Luhrmann does that as well.
Yes. But it's one of those amazing magic tricks where it's like they tell you everything that's going to happen. It doesn't ruin it for you. It, in fact, gives you a sense of clarity and a sense of, like, victory when they land each beat. Well, because it's all lining up perfectly.
The prime example of that, and you talked about this on the podcast, but Titanic, when they walk you through what happens.
The best.
It's the best, right? Because you're like, fuck, okay, great. Like, now I'm locked in and I know as it's happening what is that? It's brilliant. It's just really smart.
You create the shorthand so that when you actually get to the point where the movie is running, and Inception does the same thing. When people complain that it takes an hour to explain all the the rules. Yeah. That's so that when the movie really kicks into gear, they don't have to explain anything. Yeah, exactly. And it's just like just pure satisfaction of these things hitting on all cylinders.
That's much better than my take on the beginning. But I'm going to give it anyway.
Sure.
My very simple take was they do the thing in this that The Simpsons does all the time, which I love, which is we're going to make you think that we're telling you story A.
Yeah.
And it's actually story B. My favorite example of that is the episode where Homer gets the medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Vaguely.
Yes.
It's the episode where he has the issues with the crows.
Uh-huh. Sure,
so you start and you think it's going to be Homer versus the crows, and the crows are the ones who peck out his eyes.
They always have a false act one.
It's wonderful. I thought that's what they did, but I thought that immediately with Toy Story 2, the same exactly, the false act one, false credits sequence here, which I love, but yours is far more interesting.
It's also I think they took it from Toy Story 1. Am I not correct?
They wanted to do the sort of Buzz Lightyear in his world, so you understood how awesome he was. Right. And I think it was they never cracked where to put it, if it was front loading it. I mean, in the first one, you have the opening, the cold opening is Andy playing with them. So you have a similar kind of, all three of them start with a fictional narrative.
Yeah.
But in the first one, you see it's a kid's hand. You see that the dolls aren't moving. You understand that.
Yeah.
Two is doing the same thing, but it's putting you in the fake narrative. Yeah. Right.
Which it's kind of interesting, too. Like, I loved it. It's great. It's kind of a siloed off thing from the movie that doesn't really actually matter.
But it's also a really sophisticated, good. Like, it's like the opening of Raiders of the Lost Ark something.
Yes, yes, yes.
And this is like one of these things before you even get to like the emotional, psychological complexity of this movie. I think like critics are going like, wait a second, this is like very intelligently constructed. Yeah. Like, this is like Spielbergian like clarity. And
well, right
like,
at the gate, you get the impression that this movie is playing at another level and it's doing something pretty immediately. I think. I mean, Toy Story 1 obviously did that, but I felt like sitting in the theater for this one, you almost immediately feel like they're doubling down.
And you're they're breaking the rules they set up in the first one. Like, in what context is this scene going to gel with the rest of the film?
Yeah.
And I remember, the credits, I'm like, this is funny. And then you have the sort of speedball, you know, the fireball effect. And then when it goes in on Buzz, was never my guy. I was always a Woody guy, right? And I got the Buzz doll because I was like, I'm completionism. He's a cool toy. But I was always like, Buzz, that's not my wavelength. And I just remember when they do the cut in to his face with the flames and the Randy Newman, like, Buzz Hero theme, like, blares, I just went, that's my fucking guy. You know, it was like, I didn't even realize how much I missed you, Buzz. I thought I was here for Woody. Even Potato had a Buzz. Yeah. I was more of a Slink guy, but I was like, that's my fucking guy. Buzz Lightyear's back, baby.
I want to clarify my point. That's how I am, too.
Sure.
Buzz won me over.
Yeah.
Those are my guys are the people who Andy had, right?
Right.
Woody and his guys. And this interloper comes in and ruins their situation. And I think that's the story of Toy Story 1 to some extent. Like, how Buzz kind of reckons with the fact that he is a toy, but it's really just how wonderful it is to be a toy. How, like, toys are created
there's value in
such a way.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, there's value in being a toy. And at their core, they're all really good.
Right.
You know?
But this opening is like, we're going to show you why Buzz thinks he's so cool.
Yeah.
Because he is. I mean,
right. His whole, like, arrogant, delusional thing, it's like, let's give for all of you who had a little bit of, like, friction with Buzz in the first movie, it's like, I was happy with the story function he served, but I was like, that's not a character I'm connecting to.
Yeah. They sell you on him in those first couple minutes.
Right. You're like, Buzz rules.
Yeah.
He's Indiana Jones. Like, once he dodges the boulder, you're like, I'll go anywhere with this guy. He's effortless.
Was there a glow-in-the-dark version of Buzz?
Yeah.
I'm assuming there was. Because when he goes glow-in-the-dark, I was like, that's fucking cool.
And they have that in the first one. They don't use it as much as a story point.
Right.
But they do. Like, that was one of those things where I remember seeing it and being like, oh, these guys are good. Like, they're animating that he glows.
They know. Like, they just – I don't know. They do a phenomenal job. Basically, at this point, Andy's preparing to go to cowboy camp.
Right.
And with Woody, and while playing with him, he accidentally tears his thing. That tear – fucks you up.
Another adult gasp moment in the
theater.
We're
just like, oh, you're like, he's mortal. Like, there's just something, you know what I mean?
And especially because it's like, here's the opening. We're winning over all of you who have been holding out on Buzz, right? All the skeptics. Yeah. We're going to rope the final 10% of you in. Yeah. Then you get just utopian Andy's room.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, they're reintroducing all the characters so well that this would work even if it was the first one, which I feel like a lot of sequels take for granted. Like, well, you love the characters in the first one, so we'll just start.
Yeah.
And it's like, you need to give them like a character beat to warm them back in.
Yeah.
And all the dynamics are so good. And in the first one, like, if I had any complaints about the first one at the time, I was like, yeah, but once Woody and Buzz get abandoned, you're not getting enough Slink, Rex, Potato Head. Like, those are these fun comedic games, these, like, broader supporting characters that you're not getting enough of. So I'm already happy we're back in the room, the poker, you know, like, all this shit is, like, great. Yeah. I love Rex having the video, like, all this stuff. And then the rip is, like, so startling to what's just been, like, a joyride for, like, 6 minutes.
Yeah.
I'll go a step darker with that. As I like to do. It is always kind of an open question of what these toys are to Andy. Mm-hmm. Are they people? Are they toys? Are they pets?
Right.
When a pet breaks an arm or a paw or a leg, there's the potential that that's the end of the pet's life.
Which is kind of how the mom treats it.
Right.
You just have to know, like, toys don't last forever.
This
like,
could be the end.
When your dog gets sick, your parent has to go, like, you know, they're going to die. Like, it might not be now, but it's they're going to die probably in the next 18 months.
Yeah. It's. I mean, it's a really shocking moment. You got the tear. She puts him on the shelf.
Yeah.
And it really kind of – it's the first time where Woody feels – I don't want to say inferior, but feels like the end could.
Mortal.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Then Woody has his nightmare of being thrown away.
So another thing that was cut from the first one.
Yes, which is a phenomenal sequence.
So good,
There's something really dark, just horrifying about the vortex and this abyss that he's going in, which is – and this is 8 minutes into the movie, basically, at this point. Like, they're setting their stage for what they're going to do, which is
clear
great
economic
stuff.
Storytelling.
I mean, that was the thing, and I said this to you before you got here, Griffin, but this is the tightest script. It fucking moves.
That's
There's
my
no
kind
fat
of big
this
argument
thing.
For this movie. When I try to remove my nostalgia, my emotional connection to it and all of it, I just go, I don't know if there's a tighter script accomplishing more. A larger cast of characters who really feel like, you know, I kind of, by the time Two had come out, I was like, okay, I'm studying movies a little more serious, and I'm watching grown-up movies. I get you can't have Potato Head in the whole movie because you got to focus on a few characters. Not everyone can have that much real estate. And then this one, I was like, I was wrong. Apparently, you can put Slink in 90 straight minutes. Apparently, you can do it. And apparently, like, Rex, Jesse, Woody,
everyone.
Buzz, Prospector can all have emotional arcs.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's you say that, and it's something I didn't even register, really, but, like, to juggle all those characters as well as they do for as long as they do.
And the Rex thing is like, that's the first thing you cut.
Yeah.
It doesn't pay off into the rest of the story.
But he's also,
it pays off so well.
He's the coolest looking toy, I think. The detail of his, of the dimples and the his
just
scales.
Like such a good bit. It's like, what if a dinosaur was a Jew? Like, it's just, it's so, like, let's call it out. It's so
It's true. Good. It's true. It's great.
And this is another area where the movie.
And then he can't touch both buttons because his arms are too short.
But the movie gets lucky because it comes out after Jurassic Park.
And they have that shot, which is a great
like every
nod
kid's
to
all
it.
In on dinosaurs. Yeah. And now they just go, it's like, just what's great. The funniest thing is if it's Wallachon. And he's got an inferiority complex.
It's fantastic.
Right.
I want to make another point about the dream and kind of a point about the trilogy all together with the dream being kind of a really good illustration of this. Mm-hmm. Toy Story 1 to 3, 1 to the end, I'm far more on the 3 is my favorite and 3 works for me the best. And part of it is because 3 is the one where they drop all the pretense and they're like, all right, these aren't toys, these are people.
Sure.
You know, like these are people, they're mortal, they have feelings, they're going to die, etc. What the dream does in 2 is, you know, speaking to the rules of this, it breaks its rule, I think. Or it really kind of fills in a space that you never expected to be filled in.
Yeah.
These characters have dreams, which is like
Back
to Bicentennial, man.
Wow.
Well, but the whole point of that is like Robin Williams becomes a man.
Yeah.
He's not dreaming.
Right.
Like he's not these characters are more human than you even can imagine. Like they're exhibiting these psychological conditions that only a human can relate to.
Well, and not to get off this, you know, now that we're finally discussing the first 8 minutes of the film, 90 minutes into the podcast.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that simultaneously, like, kind of worries me and kind of excites me about the Forky thing. Where it's like, okay, so they're going to start tugging at those strings? Like, all the logical questions of, like, the inner rules of, like, where their life comes from and, like, where their sentience comes from and all that stuff? It's like these movies walk a very fine line in terms of explaining certain rules and leaving other ones open.
Well, it's magic realism, so they're
right. They're sort of buying into the aesthetic reality, and then they'll explain to you certain things. This is what this tracks onto. This is what this equates to. All of this sort of stuff. But there's like the basic sort of gimme that you give them in the first one is we're not going to explain why Buzz thinks that he's the character he's based off, and the rest of them don't. Because the rest of them all have personalities that are different from their exterior appearances, the mold of what their archetype is.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, on a basic level, why does Buzz freeze every time Andy walks in the room? Like, why does he still abide by basic toy rules, right? And so these things, it's like, you have to just give them that.
Yeah, so I mean, you don't question it, though.
You don't.
It's very dangerous. What you're talking about,
it's dangerous shit. That's why 4 is like walking this razor wire where it's like, if you're going to start to tug at this, the whole ball of yarn might come out.
It's like, and people feel how they feel, but midichlorians was a...
Fuck.
Yeah.
It could be that, and it could really fuck people up.
Don't explain away the magic.
Right.
Like, you can if you nail it.
Right.
Like, there are times where it's been nailed. I can't think of one. But there are times where it's been nailed, where there's been kind of this magical realism thing that we've accepted, and they're like, this is the true example. But if you miss it, it can fuck up the whole series, and that does scare me.
Right.
Yep.
I trust them, though.
Right. I want to. But this is the Pixar thing. The thoroughness and the asking all the questions is just like, even the things they can't explain, you get the sense that they've thought through it and decided, okay, just accept this as a rule. There's nothing that's like an oversight.
Yeah.
You know, it's these are the things we're going to explain. These are the things you just have to take as a given in this world.
I mean, it's, again, not to whatever, but like, it is a kid's movie. So yeah, there's a little, you do get a little, you get a lot of rope to be able to kind of, and they, I think they use it brilliantly in these three films. We'll see how they do it in the fourth one. But so basically at this point, Woody is mistaken for a toy at a garage sale.
Through trying to rescue
Wheezy.
Which, I mean, this is another...
I like the way you said that. He's mistaken for a toy.
Well, for a vintage, you know what I mean?
Right, but this is another thing I love about this movie, just on a pure enjoyment level, is it keeps on being structured like an Indiana Jones movie, where they're just barely avoiding the worst thing, and then there's a bad turn, and then they barely get out of that, and then there's a bad turn. Like, it constantly keeps repeating this thing of just, like, obstacle by obstacle by obstacle. And
I keep thinking about the development process and how you have to imagine that this movie is sort of like screenwriting 101.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because of, I imagine, the time constraint, but they just fucking nail it. Like, they just do it at a higher level.
Yeah.
The, you know, we're talking about the beats and the structure and the way that it actually is, but again, this is sort of, they fell back, if you will, on tropes that they just do unbelievably well.
And they did it in less time than we've already been talking about the movie.
We're only halfway done.
Sure, we're only halfway.
The reason to me that's so successful is because they are so honed in on their theme, and it's a theme that has not been explored by pop culture very often, if kind of ever.
Yeah.
So that's why I think like if you're kind of the first mover on something like this, you can just go with your kind of basic 90-minute structure.
Yeah.
Done perfectly well, executed flawlessly. Don't get me wrong, but it's the thematic resonance for me that's like making me almost cry right now.
Well, I also, I mean, this is why I rank 2 ahead of 3, is that I think 2 is just like, watching it going like, man, they're adding so much new stuff to this. Like everything they're bringing to the table is a wholly new idea that was untapped in the first one. Whether it be a toy world idea of like, okay, so what's a collectible? Mm-hmm. Like, how does this translate to, you know, a psychology? Or it's the sort of emotional resonance of the characters we've already established in different sides of their personality, different fears, all the themes, that sort of stuff. 3 does a little more retreading. And that's baked into the cake because the idea is 3 is them hitting the thing they were always worried about happening one day, which I can't hold against the movie. That's the promise they made. They wrote themselves a contract that if they make a 3, it's got to get to that point, right? It's going to be the college movie. It's going to be them facing their fears. But the fact that 2 just starts asking these questions, like, hits me so hard because you're just like, fuck, they're just going deeper and deeper and deeper and hitting new oil wells.
Yeah, I mean, they're not – there's also a courage and a fearlessness to this as well that I think is just, I mean, it taps into what you're talking about. But so basically, Wayne Knight, Al, steals Woody. Buzz Lightyear gives chase.
And it's such a good specific, like, you talk about just between character design, casting, and the actual performance of the character animation, yeah. right? You see this guy and you go, I know exactly who he is.
Yeah.
And there's even the, like, you know, first draft idea is just, he's a fat, sweaty nerd who collects toys, right? But they were like, no, he's very specifically this type of retro guy.
But the second you hear
him, that was big
in
the 90s, the, like, the faux, like, throwback sort of vintage car, vintage clothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, because his car, there was something about how, like, his car is, like, one of the cars in Cars.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, that, I think flow.
Sure, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. Yes, flow. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know your cars.
I know my cars. I wish I didn't.
Sadly.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, you know, there's something about this period in kind of film criticism, too. In the late 90s, I was reading Ain't It Cool News every day,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And I think Harry Knowles really was affected by this movie. And
yeah.
I think it was because he really saw himself in that. And Harry Knowles was, you know, he was wearing the kind of the throwback Hawaiianish shirts.
Yeah.
And he was obsessed with toys and he was obsessed with you know, the kind of franchisey movies. And I think Phil and I talked about this a little bit before the podcast, but seeing a lot of these internet, these kind of early internet movie reviewers clearly saw themselves in Al.
Yeah.
And kind of had to
deal
with the fact that maybe – I don't even know. I don't even know the kind of the way to psychologically break this down. But
I also think there's – I mean, I feel like that the children of the late 50s in the early 90s bringing back this sort of retro throwback 50s thing, you know? Like, now you have throwback diners. Now some of the, like, fashion trends are being reappropriated, even, like, through, like, swingers, you know, the greaser thing. But, like, that late 50s, early 60s thing was the first time I would argue that there was, like, a nostalgia culture that was mainstream. Mm-hmm. And then you have, like, oh, people are collecting the vintage stuff they grew up on, you know? Or they like the look of the old TV set. And then it starts this thing of, like, everyone who's in, like, their early 30s and now has some level of security, you know, starts buying or reliving or relitigating all the stuff they grew up with, which we're now starting to experience with, like, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah, I know that nostalgia is definitely back.
Right, so he's the first wave of the sort of nostalgia-driven guy.
That's interesting.
Because before that, it's like, you know, you were too concerned about dying. You know, to spend time thinking about, like, I want to go back to that stuff I loved when I was young.
Yeah, yeah.
When things felt better.
So Buzz tries to get him out, and Buzz gets a look at the license plate.
Yeah.
And then he uses the speak and spell to try to piece together what this – and my favorite was Liz Tribran.
Yeah. And it's another one of those things where it's like they're having their cake and they're eating it too. Like the emotional stakes of the thing, of Buzz really trying to make this work, figure it out, track.
Yeah.
But it also is like they're parodying like the detective standing in front of the cork board trying to work out like what's the connection between all the victims.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
I mean, they're using all these.
They walk.
But so then we get to Al's apartment, and this is sort of when the movie really begins because Woody is exposed to our new cast of characters in terms of Jesse, the prospector, Bullseye.
Yeah.
And we realize that he's being sold to a toy museum, and the stakes of the film are really kind of crystallized a little bit.
Yeah.
And Woody is – what I also kind of love is that, you know, Toy Story 1 is obviously essentially an origin story for Buzz.
Yeah.
And this is really kind of the origin story for Woody.
Yeah.
We start to realize where he came from, what his story is, which is great. Apparently, Bullseye was going to have a voice at one point.
Adam Sandler?
Martin Short.
Interesting. I had seen, I think it's on one of the DVDs or something,
yeah.
but there's one of those clips where they were testing out voices. I don't know if they ever offered to him, but it was Bullseye doing the one of the Happy Gilmore, talking to himself while he's trying
it's
to
It's so much better without it.
It's so much better without it.
Not my
him just being a dog. It's just that's
not my two guys.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so like I'm thrilled that like I didn't have to have either of those guys infiltrate my Toy Story world.
But it's also better that Bullseye is like a pure responsive reactive creature.
Pluto.
He's right. He's an instinct creature.
He's also something you feel like you can touch. Like that animation of Bullseye is fantastic.
And
like you're just like the plushness of him.
Right.
You just really.
That's a thing that Toy Story, you know, really gets is like they're really invested in the difference between materials, which matters in a movie that's about manufactured products as characters.
Sure, sure.
And it came out of them like, you know, Tin Toy. And then when they wanted to make a feature going like, well, that's the thing that's, like, easiest to do in CGI because it's, like, shiny, like, sort of plasticky surfaces. But even in the first one, when you know it must have been so tough, you get the difference of, like, the cloth versus the plastic versus what quality of plastic when it looks kind of cheap, when it looks kind of solid. And then this one, when you get the fucking bullseye pushing the dimmer and the whole menagerie of the Woody's Roundup. I interned at the Onion when I dropped out of college, and one of my many petty jobs was like literally just like going through boxes in people's office and finding all these things. And I found this article that was from 1999 that was just like an op-ed or something from like one of the New York Times like opinion columnists at the time. And it was just about how he felt that The Onion and Toy Story 2 represented an advancement in American culture of being really obsessed with the sort of the details and the feel of thing. That you can hit greater truths if you understand how to walk like something and talk like something. And how The Onion was so practiced in that fake sort of newspaper speak, applying it to absurd things or banal things or whatever it was. And the example, the thing he connected to was that reveal of the merchandise in Toy Story 2. And that it elevates the whole movie when you look at it and you get every single piece of merchandise on that thing. You get the impetus for it.
Yeah.
Without them having to showcase it, you get the function of things.
Yeah.
You get how high quality or low quality it was, what condition it's in, you know? And it's just like these guys really – they use this term at Pixar where it's like we paint the undersides of the drawers. Even if you're not going to look underneath the drawer in the dresser, it matters to us that it's painted. So that we know that we did that thoroughly.
There's also something to the fact that there's a classicism to the archetypes of toys that they're using in this.
Yeah.
You know, if this had been done by, let's just say, DreamWorks or something of that ilk,
right.
I think it would have been more of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Ready Player One situation where you would have been sort of a cavalcade of brands, of toys.
Right, where you get Potato Head's riffing on that.
Yeah, right. Potato Head's – and obviously you get Barbie and stuff like that.
Right.
But, like, they created their own underneath the umbrella of, like, you get this type of toy. As opposed
Which
to
is huge.
Trying to brand out a whole bunch of other fucking toys.
And it's also one of the things that I think just makes this movie, all three of these movies, so visually compelling is it's such a weird-looking group of characters together. Because they're such radically different sizes and densities, you know? And it's also like, you know, when you remove it, you go, this is a movie that stars like an astronaut, a cowboy, a dinosaur.
A potato head.
You know,
a slinky
like,
dog,
right, but it's just like, even if you just don't engage with them as toys and you engage with them as the thing that they're toys of, it's compelling to see all those types of characters talk to each other.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So speaking about the merchandising, there's a great scene in it where Woody sees all the merchandise that we were talking about, and he tries all of it. And that apparently was – they just recorded Tom Hanks actually looking at the merch for the first time. So all of that stuff is just him going like the bubbles. Oh, the bubble.
And
like,
it's
just
the
Tom Hanks just doing Tom Hanks. It's just his responses to the Woody merchandise
there's
they put in front of
the – in my boot.
It's just great.
It feels so real. It's so naturalistic.
Yeah,
it almost can't – it's one of those things can't be written. And you just can't imagine them figuring that out for an animated movie like this.
It's fantastic.
No, and it's like awe-inspiring, and then it builds to that sort of just like pure ecstatic joy moment of all of them dancing on the record player.
Yeah,
then the immediate rug pull of like the museum in Japan.
And like, I don't want to go there.
Right.
I got to go back to Andy. Andy's waiting for me.
Right.
It's, you know, and then you get Jesse's panic. You get the prospector starting to realize that he's going to have to convince this guy. And then
that's what's crazy though. You go like, so within like 3 minutes of Woody waking up in Al's apartment, right? You introduce all the characters. You introduce the cultural context for Woody as what kind of item he is, his relationship to media, right? His value.
Yeah.
Then you have this moment that's just pure joy. And then, I mean, maybe it's 5 minutes. But then in all of this, the emotional stakes of how already they're emotionally reliant on each other.
Yep.
You know, that it's a betrayal that Woody doesn't want to go to the museum. And that Woody's already – that Jesse has already invested her future in the idea of Woody.
Because she immediately is like, we're good to go. She is all in. And then to have that taken from her again really sets her off.
And I think this is where like I now am able to psychoanalyze it more. But where Jesse hits so hard for me is that like I am a like super depressive, anxious person. It's like terrified and overwhelmed by everything. And it mostly manifests as me being a goofball.
But it's, I mean, just the prospector saying, I promise you'll come out of the box.
Right.
Is just like, my God.
Right. And she's actually having a like well-animated panic attack.
No, I feel it. Like,
right.
I mean, I'm
like the shortness of breath thing, which you just go like, she doesn't have lungs. There's no reason.
Yeah,
you know, is this a learned trait? Is she just mimicking something?
Yeah. It's really powerful.
But it's visceral.
So he loses his arm, and then we get a really wonderful, the Cheeto minefield. is just really – this is – to me, there's a couple moments in this film where you sort of see Pixar learning – sort of a visual filmmaking in a way that maybe they hadn't done before. The scope is the thing. You know, they've everything got bigger. Bugs Life changed everything to a certain extent, but like the scope is bigger in this film.
And it's another like when they pan out and you see the full range of the Cheetos and the audience goes, oh
shit.
Like, this is bad.
Yeah.
And then if you engage with it, you're like, he's like 10 inches tall and there are Cheetos on the floor. Like, but they set up the relative stakes so it feels as insane as like poison darts in the cave in Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. And this movie just keeps on doing these sort of mousetrap setups of like, here's the risk, here's all the ways it could go wrong, and here's how they're going to keep narrowly avoiding.
And then you've got the pylon sequence, which is another perfect visual thing of the toys trying to get to Al's Toy Barn across the street. So they hide under the pylons.
Yeah.
And then you just have all the car crashes that they create with the pylon. Like, it's just – it's you don't even dialogue. Like, that's what I love about this shit is they can tell so much story visually.
It's one of those things where that was in the direct-to-video version on the DVDs and the Blu-rays and what have you. You can see that as a deleted scene, which animation rarely has deleted scenes because, as we said, we work the these things out before you start actually animating. And there's just a shittier version of that crossing the street scene. That was always in there, but it's the most basic version of it without sort of any cinematic sophistication, intelligence of the stakes building and all of that. And, I mean, even just you keep on revealing things about the characters. You know, you have the Cheeto reveal. It feels like it's just, okay, this is an obstacle course. How does Woody get through this? But then Bullseye, is he going to fuck this up? And the fact that Woody doesn't turn to Bullseye with anger, that he's frustrated in the stakes, but he immediately realizes, like, this isn't innocent, and he looks up to me, and I need to, like, protect him and help him, you know?
It's just,
not mess this up for me.
It's just, it's fantastic.
It's so good.
There's obviously an attention to detail in the Pixar films that just gets better and better and better.
Yeah.
But the attention to detail in the cleaning sequence when he's fixing Woody and making him look perfect and brand new. I never saw Jerry's Game, I don't think, the short. That this character
is... It was
before
A Bug's Life.
Oh, was it? I don't think I saw Bug's Life in the theater. I might have.
Yeah. But that won
that character
Oscar,
won an Oscar, and then that character is the guy that cleans him.
And it was literally one of those things where, like, the movie was so behind schedule and so over budget that they were like, we can't create a new character. Like, they came up with this story idea.
So funny.
And they were like, can we pull, like, what do we have in the files?
Wow.
So they literally just, like, transferred the data over.
See, that's
and like,
awesome.
That would work, right?
Like, just happy mistakes that are just – you just – this stuff is also great, too. Just, like, the nicks in his little thing that he opens up and the way that little –
like
the motor.
History. And it's another thing where you walk in, you're just like, I know exactly who this guy is.
Yeah.
I know exactly who he is. It's Roddy McDowell, insanely overqualified for this type of role. But they're like, it matters.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. Yeah.
And I think it also can kind of serve as a counterweight to the whole Al thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think Al is kind of taken on its own, meant to make people feel bad about kind of holding on to their childhood.
Sure.
Yes.
And I think the cleaner, in another way, is kind of made to make people feel like it's okay to care about these things, objects, inanimate objects in this way. Like, they were important to your childhood is important as long as you respect it or treat it with respect.
And also the craft of this thing. Like, whether or not it's a piece of high art, you know, or consumer merchandise, there were deliberate thoughts put into the design and the manufacturing of this thing, which the cleaner seems to appreciate. Al is crass. I mean, he's commercial.
He's trying to make money.
You know, the second he completes his collection, it's to flip it.
Yeah.
So even if he loves Woody's Roundup and it started coming from that place, you know, and he, like, owned a toy store because he loves toys, he doesn't seem to get any joy from any of these things anymore.
He's the guy who greenlit Cars 3, basically.
The guy who greenlit Cars 3. He's what John Lasseter becomes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. So all our toys, our gang gets to Al's Toy Barn, and all this stuff is great. I mean, it's kind of shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, they put toys in a toy store, so, like, it's going to work,
but
probably.
This is one of those movies where it's, like, a kind of equally balanced A and B plot. I mean, you essentially have two A plots. Mm-hmm. It's fully half and half, and you're never disappointed when they cut from one to the other.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And
I
it's,
think
like,
that
with
the Buzz
stuff's
great.
You're getting your, like, action movie stakes, you know?
And the swap, identity swap, which is great.
Right.
Which is brilliant.
Because the Woody stuff is confined to one room, and that's all your, like, emotional weight.
It's just – I mean, there's also – there's so many jokes in the personality swap or in the mistaken identities of old Buzz and new Buzz. And the new Buzz, us being able to re-enjoy buzz from the first one.
That's what they said.
It's great.
Found such a fun comedic game with him being this Boy Scout character.
Yeah, it's just great.
We had him grow. Yeah. You don't want RoboCop 2 where the movie starts and all the progress he's made right. towards his humanity is gone. That's depressing.
Well, nobody wants RoboCop
right.
2.
Right. Well, I agree with you. Yes.
But that happens all the time. Like, that's Homeland Season 2, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
The memory wipe moves.
You gotta let the characters it's grow. It's depressing bad. And immediately shoot yourself in the foot if you try to give the audience what you think they want. But they find a way to once again have their cake and eat it too.
They find a way to make them funny again.
And Buzz's characterization is so specific in terms of him still, through training, being this, like, high-intensity sort of action star, but he's grounded in reality.
He's also, like, when he's in the packaging screaming, you have the wrong Buzz, you've got the wrong Buzz.
Right.
Like, when Buzz gets to, like, crazy Woody levels, it's also really fun.
And it's also, it's also great when you see him with, like, utility belt Buzz.
Yes.
And you realize how far the character actually has come.
I agree.
How much they've let him grow, because now the contrast is like, oh, I didn't realize we were all the way back there.
Yeah.
In the first one, the belt thing is so good.
Pig asks him about the slotted pig in standard issue. It's fantastic.
Yeah, all those names are
fantastic.
So good. Yeah,
it's such a
and I
line.
Like that they just sort of go like, I don't know. I guess Buzz is like back in a weird pocket. Like they acknowledge that something's different.
Something's amiss, but they're also like, I don't know. He's weird.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, so now you basically have the prospector trying to convince Woody that he's got to come. And we had the conversation earlier. You know, you think Andy's going to take you on his honeymoon? It's a real fucking dig, but I mean it's good stuff.
Where's Andy now? Like that thing he says where, you know, like Andy, the one who like put you at a yard sale, and Woody's like, it's not like that. And he's like,
it's kinda like that.
Kinda? Yeah.
No, it's not like that.
Yeah.
That's not no.
No,
whereas
but,
Andy, Andy's at cowboy camp. This guy is still very much into
Prospector
Woody.
Is using like whataboutism though.
Yeah.
He's like, or is it not true that Andy put you on a shelf?
Yes.
And he's like, I can't argue with that. And he's like, and is it or is it not true that you then ended up at a yard sale?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like Andy loves you.
Yeah.
Right.
So Woody decides to stay.
Yeah.
And he's like, he believes that, you know, they're gonna get discarded, but he successfully gets in his head.
Well, and also you have the Jesse song sequence. I mean, this is where this kicks in, where he goes, look, I understand. Prospector, who at this point you still think is a nice guy, you realize later is playing mind games with Woody. Yeah. Goes,
and using
I
Jesse
get it,
to do that.
But I don't know if Jesse will get it. You have to explain it to her. And from the moment you just cut to her, like, in fetal position, looking out the window, you go like, what is this?
She's so broken.
Right. Like, where this movie is just having, like, a character, like, quietly sit in their pain.
Yeah. Just and very introspective.
Much like they would do later in Toy Story 3. Not much like it. It's actually what's kind of remarkable about this moment in Toy Story 2 to me.
Yeah.
Is it doesn't feel like Woody is making the wrong choice. He's just making another choice.
It's a tough decision.
It's a tough
It's not a binary didactic good versus bad. He wants to help everybody.
Yes.
You know?
And I think he's made the calculation that Jesse specifically, but Bullseye 2 and Prospector 2 really need me a lot more than Buzz and the crew. Actually, they have a new me.
Well, it's like his work family versus like his family.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not like he just wants to be loved in a museum like Prospector. He also wants to help them out. That is valid. Like, he's still investing in relationships.
Yeah.
For
he's
sure.
He's still trying to help people. I mean, he has this complex of needing to lead and needing to guide and needing to organize and all of that. But he comes to that, and I think, like, here's a 2-versus-3 thing. You have the explanation of Lotso's backstory, which is very similar to the Jesse thing, except rather than being broken by it, you become evil, right? But in that one, you have, like, Chuckles narrating it and, like, really explaining it and putting such a fine point on it, whereas, like, the restraint of this and just the sort of, like, when she lands under the bed, it hits so much harder than saying, and then Emily moved on.
It's a bit of an indictment of teenage girls.
I don't know. I mean, like,
just a little bit.
I understand,
so
I understand
that. Character details. And once again, I still think 3 is one of the 100 best films ever made.
I'm so into the conceit of the prison break thing, the conceit of this guy's scene things.
Oh, that stuff rules.
Yeah, but
I think
the last thing is, like, to that, too. Like, it's that – it's this guy has seen things.
Yeah.
Like, that I'm bought in the way they tell that story.
I love his backstory. And, I'm literally just speaking to the confidence with which they tell you that backstory.
Yeah.
And in 3, they feel – it feels they are a little more pressured to explain it. Mm-hmm. And in two, they trust, like, Randy Newman tells the story where they were like, he was like, so what's on deck? What do you want me to do for this one? And they, like, explained to him. He was like, you can't do that in a kid's movie. You're going to break the thing.
Yeah.
And that, like, when he sat there in the audience and it played, he was like, Jesus Christ, these lunatics. They knew what they were talking about. Yeah, like, really the kids and the parents are both 100% getting it and emotionally engaged with this thing. And so many little details of, like, you know, the world from Jesse's perspective, underneath the bed, seeing time pass, unable to touch it, and just, like, the phone, the base of the phone being dragged on the floor. Like, only seeing her feet and the objects, you get the evolution of Emily and the stages she's going through in her adolescence.
Which, again, comes back to the fact that, like, there's an argument to be made that all these Toy Story films could be entirely silent.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could tell these, and it's a testament to how incredible Pixar is at that. I mean, first hour of WALL-E proves that. Yeah. I mean, you just...
Tin Toy is entirely silent and gets at a lot of the psychological complex of being a toy. There's the amazing moment where he hides under the couch and he sees all the other toys who have been hiding from the baby for, like, years.
Sure.
And just without any dialogue, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So at this point, basically, our team has pieced together Al's plan. They've gone back to his apartment. They're looking to bust Woody out, essentially, and bring him home.
Right, and it's this beautiful, like, confluence thing where it's like Woody makes his decision just as they break through the grate.
Yeah.
And you've had the buzz break and completely mirror the opening Zurg video game.
Yeah. It's just – it's really, really, really smart.
Yeah.
So basically at this point
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Buzz. There's two Buzzes.
Yeah.
And to prove his identity, he lifts up his foot to show that he's got Andy's name on it, which is just like, it's just
right after what he does. Yeah. You get your curtain, not your curtain call, your reprise of the the helmet gag.
Yep. Which is also fantastic. Yeah.
Right. And then he just sort of nonchalantly kicks just lifts his foot up.
It's just fantastic.
But I also like at this point you still care for the second Buzz. I mean, when you get to the emotional stakes of his Zurg battle, it's like you get what this means to him. You understand it has no relative danger within their world.
Yeah.
But it means everything to him. And you give Rex a win.
And you give Rex a win.
And you give Rex a win.
Yeah, he gets to beat the video game in real life.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
It's incredible.
It's also a nice it's a nice counterweight to the whole franchise filmmaking today, where everything is about the end of the world.
Yes,
this is literally it couldn't be further from that. This is about a toy winning something that's only important to him, and you care. I care way more about this than I do about Infinity War.
Well, you know, I like prequels often don't work, and Infinity War is a great example. I was about to tee it up as well. Prequels often don't work, but I feel like people misunderstand why prequels don't work, and I hear always the complaint where it's like, "Well, like, what are the stakes? We know the characters aren't going to die." As if the only thing that could have stakes in a movie is life and death.
Yeah.
And, like, that's not the case. I think few prequels are smart enough about understanding how to get stakes when you know what the character's sort of status quo is before coming in, because it's so much about character growth.
Yeah.
You know that there's tension in where they're going to end up internally, where they stand with each other. And, like, this movie is just, like, whether it's them crossing the street where they literally could be crushed by a truck, or like a phony fight between Zurg and Buzz in an elevator shaft where it's like ping pong balls, you get the relative stakes of what it means to them. Balls. Yeah. And like that's the end of the day. I think like Infinity War, I don't care that all of them die because I immediately know that none of it matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And like people go like, well, that's the point. It's a comic movie. Of course they're going to save the day. Of course they're going to bring people back to life. But I go like, if Infinity War was 2.5 hours long and they were killing off a different character every 10 minutes, I would care more. Yeah. Losing characters one by one, even knowing the next movie would reverse most of them, than I do where, like, at the end, a guy snaps his fingers, yeah, and then a bunch of people disintegrate, and it's like, it's to paraphrase the Incredibles thing, where it's like, if everyone's super, that's another way of saying that nobody is. Mm-hmm. Like, if there's so much in terms of the stakes, of like, you understand, the world is ending, everyone's going to die, it just becomes white noise to me. It's like all guitar solo. Yeah, you become numb.
It's just really, there's also just sort of, sometimes, I guess to your point, when the stakes become so large,
yeah,
you just can't even process it.
Correct.
Essentially.
Right, right.
Like, these stakes might feel small, but they're intimate. And because of that, it has so much more of an emotional impact on you.
There's some stat that I'm going to fuck up now, but where, like, human beings have a hard time processing a tragedy over a certain size.
Mm.
You know, like, when people say, like, I still can't even, like, reckon with, like, 9/11. It's mm-hmm. so hard to even comprehend. But it's so much easier to engage in, like, the human tragedy of, like, three people getting murdered in a weird way.
It's palpable. It feels right. more palatable.
Right. Yeah. And that's where, like shootings, like when mass shootings come up, not a thing I thought I was going to invoke in a Toy Story 2 episode. Yeah. But there's like something where it's a smaller number and the news is covering the specific people in their backstory. When it becomes so large, it's just like, I can't even process how sad this is, how tragic it is. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it becomes white noise,
yeah,
but it's hard to really engage with like the individual people you've lost.
Yeah.
And this movie feels like it should be pushing the limits in terms of how much they're putting on the plate.
Yeah.
How many different subplots, how many characters you have in there, their separate wants and needs. Yeah. But it's so clear at every point what they want, and they're so smart about just having those things sort of harmonize with
together.
Each other, dovetail together.
Yeah, they do it really, really beautifully. I mean, basically at this point, we're essentially at the place where, you know, we're at the airport,
yeah,
and, you know, they're on their way to Japan. That plane was really, really close to taking off, by the way. I mean, it was within inches. But basically, you know, Buzz on Bullseye essentially comes and saves the day.
I mean, this is like, you ask me, this is the most exciting filmmaking. There's nothing that gets me more amped up than this.
It's
you know?
The best. And it's just, it's clever too, him using his pull string to clamp onto the bottom of – it's just all just great. And him saying – but the cliffhanger thing, which I love, where she's like, but the show is canceled. And he's like, let's see how it ends together. It's just great. Like, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it.
Right. And it's this thing of like, you know – your narrative culturally, what you've been told is your story and your lane, and Woody deciding to take control of his own narrative.
Yeah.
You know?
Story. Yeah,
he's trying to reconcile everything. He's trying to have it all. He understands it's hard work and there's sacrifices to be made, but he wants to
he's willing to do it.
Both families intact. Yeah. You know? And he's willing to take the risk to try for that. And I mean, there's so many good things. I mean, the luggage conveyor belt thing.
Classic.
I have always thought it's such a missed opportunity that they never did an airport ride at one of the Disney theme parks for Toy Story 2. Because there's that moment even where they're going through the flats and then you see and they have the sort of Splash Mountain drop down. But I mean, you just set up all these things. Like, the stakes are so clear. Find the case, you know?
Yeah.
But also Stinky Pete is on the loose.
Yeah.
And the spatial geography is always clear, even when they pointedly set up, like, an M.C. Escher.
Yeah.
Like, well, a maze of
layers.
We talked
about the doors in Monsters, Inc. You know what I mean? Like, and even in Coco, when he goes to the land and it punches out. Like, the intricate detail.
They're so good at setting up an internal system.
They are.
And letting you know the rules kind of wordlessly, you know, or with minimal wording so that you're just, like, running with it. This plane stuff, I mean, it now feels really big. And it's not about life or death, but, like, they get to something that feels like it's at the end of a Fast and Furious movie
they do,
where they're, like, trying to jump out of a plane onto a moving horse.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. And, I you know, my father there's the moment when they're trying to break in to Al's apartment after all the Al's Toy Barn stuff, which is just another, like, great. Like, that's a thing we didn't get to in the first movie. What's it like at a toy store? Here are the Barbies. They have their resort. They're their own worlds. All of that sort of stuff. But when they finally get into the apartment and the doors are about to close and Mr. Potato throws his hat and it lodges the door open just that much.
Yeah.
And the whole audience laughed. And I turned to my father. I said, why are they laughing? What's the joke there? And his response was, it's just so perfect. Now, what he meant was the joke is, look how well they just barely made it. But I also just feel that way of like this ending of, you know, the emotional stakes are so clear. Here's Woody on the runway, you know, with Jesse in the plane. here's Buzz on Bullseye. He's the one actually on the runway.
Yes.
Catching the hat. Yeah. You know where they all are all to in relation to each other. And then just the way it just – they earn it turning out that perfectly. Mm-hmm. That he lassos. It latches perfectly onto the lug nut.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect swing. The four of them land perfectly on the thing. And it's just like, just what a fucking triumph. You know, like, yes, like give them their win.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And then they're scared when a plane flies over and they're like, let's go home.
Yeah, well, and I even like in another movie, I'd be like, okay, a little too much on the, let's go home. Like Hanks really winds up that line, but it's like, you know what? You've earned it. You can do whatever the fuck you want, Toy Story 2. Because it's also that moment. It's so exciting to see Buzz with Bullseye and Jesse, because the movie's been setting up that he might have to pick one or the other.
It also leads to one of my favorite moments in this film, which is the reveal of the luggage vehicles outside, because then you're imagining those toys driving that all the way back to Andy's. It's just so fantastic.
So funny. Yeah.
It's just great.
And just like smart Pixar, like just cut to the home.
Yeah.
And for a moment, you go like, that's weird. Why aren't they explaining how they got home? Mm-hmm. I remember seeing this for the third time or whatever with my mom, and I went, don't worry, Pixar's got it. Don't worry. Like, she thought she had, like, outsmarted the movie. And that's I was like, amazing. Mom, hold your horse.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Over 20 films, right? Over 20 films.
Yeah.
I've seen, I think, like 18 of them.
Uh-huh.
They never disappoint me in that respect.
Yeah.
You can't be smarter than these movies.
They're going to give you an answer, and they're going to execute it in a way that is either the best emotional payoff or the best comedic payoff.
It's such a good joke
of just the body language of the two adults across the street with the coffee cups trying to figure out what the fuck happened.
Yeah.
It's just great.
It's great.
And then you just get to like here's the curtain call. Like here's the entire cast like all together.
And a musical sequence. And
Robert Goulet playing Wheezy.
It's just great.
It's the best.
They care so much.
Yeah.
They care so much about giving everybody the best experience you can have.
That's the thing. Yeah. I have goosebumps now, but it's like that is a moment where I just remember sitting there and being like, these son of a bitches, they did it. Toy Story 2. Like they brought it home without missing a beat, and now they're like playing me out with a song, you know?
And then bloopers.
Right, and literally just like, oh God. I mean, even before the bloopers, I went full meal, couldn't eat another bite. You've given me everything I've ever wanted and more. And then they slide over a limoncello, you know? They're gonna give you a digesti. But I just think, like, I'm so, I mean, you have the nice, like, oh, Buzz and Jesse, that's fun.
Nice.
It's so cool that they give her the badass moment of her doing the,
and him just being like,
getting the wing boner. But it's also, you know, it's so key, and it's a little thing they don't put too much attention onto, but she's driven by the same thing as Buzz. Jesse's character as a character on the TV show was, she looks out for the critters. And so what gets her to do the whole Hot Wheels run is that Buster needs to go outside to use the bathroom. And a critter's in danger! And Joan Cusack, I saw her do some interview where it's just like, you know, I went in, I was like, it's a cowgirl, I guess I should do a Southern thing or a Western thing. And they were like, no, we want the Joan Cusack voice. And the movie's just like, accept that it's just a Chicago cowgirl.
Yeah.
She's so great.
She's so great. She's fantastic. I think she's one of the most undervalued actors alive.
Absolutely.
I think we never give her enough credit.
It's especially
weird that she's someone who's been nominated for 2 Academy Awards and still people don't take her seriously.
It's bizarre.
What was the other one? It was In-N-Out, which is...
And Working Girl.
So Working Girl feels... I knew there was one that kind of felt right in its own way. In-N-Out, which everyone knew was coming, that award nomination.
She's so good in that. Yeah.
Oh, she's fantastic. Amazing. In that movie. Yeah. Those are my favorite nominations. But Marissa Tomei's and Joan Cusack in In-N-Out. So those ones that...
That's actually
Jack Palance.
Those ones where you're like, this is really good work that you feel like they're going to ignore. They're not going to take it seriously because of the genre it's in or the size of the role, the actor not being experienced.
Yeah.
Like when Tilda Swinton won the Oscar for Michael Clayton, I was like, that's cool because it's not a super showy performance.
Yeah,
that's
true. And she's great. And it is
so strong in a movie that feels like it could be in worse hands, just kind of like a shitty...
Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of Grissom knockoff.
Well, this is a good segue to next week for us, which is we're doing our Oscar episode.
Oh, I don't – wait. I get it. We're going way long. Yeah. Don't really care. I want to do the top 5 Pixars.
Okay.
Don't you?
Okay.
Yeah, I do.
We'll talk about both of these.
We need to do this relatively quickly.
All right. I'll give you mine.
This is my number one with a bullet. There's no question.
What else? Because
it's
got
the greatest American film ever made. I mean, it's not even a, like, what's my favorite film of 99? What's my favorite Pixar?
Right.
It's like, this is it for me. You know, I'd say I have a couple movies that are almost tied with it, but I give this the intellectual edge just because I go, this thing can't be tighter.
Right.
It can't be stronger.
What makes you happy?
What is close?
What's close to me? Brewster McCloud, the Robert Altman movie, which is the polar opposite, is the loosest, shambliest, free associative movie, but that movie's just on my wavelength, comedically and philosophically. but I can't argue, like, there are 1,000 problems with that movie. And I go, what can I say? I love it. Love it as much as I love any movie. Just works for me. Toy Story 2, I can argue everything that's perfect.
Sure.
I'd say RoboCop is just a hair below those two for me.
Wow.
Ed Wood's in my 5.
I'm looking forward to that episode.
I think it's a good one. And then I'm trying to think. The 5th one is maybe a little more flexible. That's definitely my heart.
Those are your heart.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Your RoboCop episode was fantastic.
Thank you. It was one
of my favorite episodes of your podcast. But that's cool that you've done a few of them. And I could see an Altman in your future, right?
Yeah. David, who I co-host the show with, is also a big Altman fan. So if we did it, we would just do the 70s run because he made so many movies.
Yeah.
But the 70s run is pretty incredible, starting with MASH, and then we would fudge it a little and end with Popeye, which is 80, which is the run where he...
Blank check movie.
Right, and that's him running out the last inch of his MASH cachet.
Okay. Yeah.
Right, before people were like, you're going to have to fight for every movie from here on out.
And he did, and he made a lot of them.
Yes. So my I'd say my top 5 Pixar, I would go, this is number 1. Then I would maybe say, and this is the day. You're asking me on this day. It could shift with the wind, right? I'd maybe say Ratatouille is number 2. I've really upped my appreciation for that one just in terms of how the fuck is that a movie?
Yeah.
That is the sweatiest premise in the world. That thing should fall apart.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I would go, I think original Toy Story, Wall-E, Incredibles. I think that's my 5. I'd say Coco is 6, sometimes cracking into 5. And then I'd go like Inside Out, Monsters, Inc., you know, Toy Story 3. That's sort of my bottom 5 there.
All of my 5 are in your 10.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, think all of your 5 are in his 10, but yeah, we don't have the same.
I mean, Wall-E's number 1 for me. Then Inside Out, Incredibles, Toy Story 2, Ratatouille.
I'll say, I mean, on certain days, Wall-E's my 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wall-E just kills me.
Wall-E slaps. I mean, it does.
It kills me.
That's another artistic audacity movie.
It really is.
Just like,
I mean, it's I guess his blank check in his own way. I mean, he's just kind of really.
That's the end of the run.
I mean, I guess John Carter is.
That's the crazy thing is that Toy Story 2's existence almost completely demolishes the Disney-Pixar relationship.
Right.
Because they were for years fighting legally over whether Toy Story 2 counted as one of the movies against their 5-picture deal because it was released theatrically. Mm. But Disney said, yeah, but we originally thought it was direct-to-video. And they were so burned by that Pixar was like, fuck this.
I mean, I remember when Pixar was very close to leaving Disney. Like, they were just like, fuck it, we're going out.
And that they produced 3 movies internally, independently, self-financed, which they just said, whoever acquires us, you know, whoever we get a distribution deal with, they'll get them. And those are Up, Wall-E, and Ratatouille, which are the 3 that are the
craziest. Weirdest. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They could never sell to shareholders, you know?
So
what are your 5?
Oh God, I want to talk about more all these movies, but my 5 are very much in your 5. It's Toy Story 3, Inside Out, Monsters, and Coco, all perfect hundreds for me.
Yeah.
I
think they've essentially made 10 movies that are flawless.
I would agree with that.
And then, my squabbles, if I had them, are petty.
Yeah.
And then Wall-E is number 5 for me because I do think Wall-E, just for me, is a perfect movie.
Yeah.
Dealing with things that I'd never imagined any movie, let alone an animated movie, to be dealing with, doesn't have the exact same emotional component for me that those first 4 do.
I get really worked up on Wall-E. I will say, when people complain about Wall-E, they go like, oh yeah, like the first 45 minutes are incredible, and then once you get to the ship, it dips off. And I'm like, I agree the first 45 minutes are the best of it, but it's literally like it goes from being the first best movie of all time to being the 5th best movie of all time.
No,
like, I'm fine with that drop-off.
And people forget, too, like, yes, I agree, like, it gets plottier once they get to the ship, but you still get them dancing in space.
That stuff still is cracking. Yeah, it's
unbelievable.
Totally
I like the second half as much as the first half. I love the Eva relationship.
I think it's
so beautiful.
I think it's just the audacity of the first half.
Yeah.
You don't get the same rush in the second half of just like the movie still is as great, as strong, but the first half you're like, how are they doing this?
Just like I Am Legend.
Yes. I mean,
I don't get that reference.
You haven't seen the movie?
No, I've seen it.
Yeah, because the first 40 minutes or so is just Will Smith just driving around with a dog. And just like, oh, cool.
If the movie was the first 45 minutes, I kind of argue Will Smith would have won Best Actor that year.
It's good for the first 45 minutes, and then you're like, oh, then
you know, I mean,
I'm just, anyway.
Next week.
We are doing our Oscar episode.
Sure.
We're going to have Eric Anderson on, who does awards daily, and Todd Vanderwerf connected us.
Yeah.
And he's going to be great.
99's a weird one because it's one of those years where you're like...
Do you want to guess what we're doing?
We are doing one of the Best Picture nominees.
You're doing one of the Best Picture nominees.
I'm not sure where it ranks in the five.
Five.
You say it's five of the five?
It's probably five.
Cider House Rule?
Yes.
That's a hard five.
We've done Green Mile.
Sure.
Which is... five in a lot of years.
Yeah.
But
it's not good.
But I haven't seen Cider House Rules since 99, 2000, whenever I saw that video.
I mean, Cider House Rules was when Weinstein had, like, reserve parking. Yeah. Like, it was just, one slot, he's going
to
fit something in there.
And that's
sometimes
to be the movie.
It's good and artistic, and sometimes it's like a Lassie Hallström. Sometimes he slips a chocolat.
Yeah,
right. And you're like, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's handsome, whatever.
It's an interesting year. The five nominees were a weird batch of movies, considering 99.
And you look in all the categories, like, some stuff they got so right in ways that were kind of audacious where you're like Toni Collette in Sixth Sense is an example of a performance you think they would overlook. Spike Jones, like
I mean him getting a Best Director nomination, that's a big deal for being John
were
Malkovich.
Were there two lone Best Directors that year? Because what
believe
it was Jones,
was there,
Michael Mann.
Yes.
Was there a international
M. Night Shyamalan? Darabont doesn't get
Darabont
nominated.
Doesn't
you
get
know
nominated.
What? It was Topsy Turvy. Might be, right?
It might have. Hold on.
Right. I think Sam Mendes wins.
Sam Mendes wins.
It was Mike Leigh who did Topsy Turvy, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think he got a nomination.
I think that's very possible. Because they will do that with him a lot. I feel like they did the same thing with Vera Drake, where he got a lone director.
Yeah, Altman got one for movie that was not nominated
Shortcuts,
for Best Picture.
Yeah.
But in the later 2000s, it was like the...
No, you know what? I'm sorry. It was Sam Mendes, Lasse Hallström got one for Cider House
Rules.
Are
you fucking kidding me?
Wait, so there were
Spike Jones, Michael Mann, and M. Night.
Well, how unfortunate.
I mean,
it's really unfortunate.
I'll say four of those are really cool.
Yeah.
You know, not just in terms of the work they did, but like, you know, Mendes all run hot and cold on before those, you know, and American Beauty has aged the worst relative to its status at the time.
We've talked about it, even though I still have affinity for it in some ways.
You know what? At some point, we should do it again.
I agree.
At the end of this, because it was our first podcast we did.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really kind of horrible.
We have a complicated relationship with that film I think for a myriad of reasons. But 99 was just an interesting year. I look at the Best Supporting Actress nomination as the one that I'm like. So you've got Catherine Keener being John Malkovich, Samantha Morton, Sweet and Lowdown, Toni Collette for The Sixth Sense, Chloe Sevigny for Boys Don't Cry, and then the winner is Angelina Jolie for Girl Interrupted, which is arguably not the one that should have won.
I would agree, and I was going to say all of these are worthy winners, and I was forgetting who won.
Right.
I don't think she's undeserving.
I
think the other four are
she's
better.
She's the weakest of that.
Literally,
of that
if any of those other four won, you'd go, that was a year the Oscars got it right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, look, I really do think Kathy Keener and being John Malkovich is the best supporting actress performance in the history of cinema.
It's incredible.
It's unbelievable what she pulls off in that movie to me. In kind of a Tilda Swinton and Michael Clayton way.
Yeah.
Because she's incredible.
It's not showy.
It's not flashy in a very flashy movie with Cameron Diaz wearing a fright wig and weird acne.
It's deceptively complicated work.
Yes.
Yeah.
That she makes look easy. I mean, that's Catherine Keener's thing, is somehow she makes everything look very casual and breezy.
I think it was just a year, and I think we've obviously talked about this ad nauseum to a certain extent, but it was a year where the gluttony of how many great movies we had, and these are the five nominees,
it almost
is strange.
Circuited everybody.
It kind of did. Like, I mean, you have your Magnolias, you're being John Malkovich, Eyes Wide Shut, a whole bunch of just like movies that in any other year would be, you know.
Talented and I would argue Keener – I mean, Cate Blanchett and Talented Mr. Ripley.
She's fantastic.
As any of them. But I would say Keener – Sevigny and Collette are all the kind of performances that people usually complain about not making it in.
Right.
Yeah.
And all three of them got in.
Yes.
Jolie, where that was the Star is Born Oscar, which they'll do sometimes where it's just like we got to deny that this person. And then who's the fifth person again?
Samantha Morton, is that who it was?
Right, yeah. Which is another example where she was viewed as a surprise that she got in. Exactly. And that was like, that's a performance that no one is giving credit to. She's going to be slept on, and then she gets the nomination.
And then you look at the Best Supporting Actor, and you're just like, Michael Caine wins for Cider House Rules, which is just
over
crazy.
Tom Cruise.
Over Tom Cruise for Magnolia, yeah. Over Haley Joel for Sixth
Michael
Sense.
Clark Duncan, who's the only reason that movie works.
Yeah. Sure. It's true.
If you're going to give that movie credit for working, you know, you can have your problems with the character. And he's doing good work.
And the fifth one in that category is Jude Law and Talented Mr. Ripley, which wins, I think, 99 out of 100 years.
Yes. Right.
Yes. Right? Because like, that is
that's
your
the
male star.
That's the star.
That's the star.
That's the male star.
He is such a star in that movie and so good and so beautiful, but like also fucking Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is fantastic in Magnolia. That's him basically sort of at the last moment of real relevancy on an awards level. He tries to get it back a little bit later.
He is as good in that movie as Buzz Lightyear is in Toy Story.
Agree.
It is that same thing where I'm
right, because we all agree, I mean, if they had run Buzz as supporting rather than co-lead, and that's the problem is that Woody and Buzz sabotage each other and neither got in Best Actor. And the Cruise thing is you just kind of can't imagine he's the last movie star who will ever be sort of that big and that kind of clean as he was up until a point where people became way too aware of what's going on inside his brain, where it was like, this guy is just a symbol. He's just an icon, and he's like a technician who knows how to operate his own vehicle. You know, he's like an amazing sports car that's well handled. And the fact that he had the audacity to do that performance is the crazy thing. Now, I remember at the time a lot of people going, well, it's like Tom Cruise and he's winning the precursors because like people can't get over like the fact that it's weird that he took on that movie. It's kind of stunt casting. Is it True Grit? Is it Ingrid Bergman and like Murder on the Orient Express? Mm-hmm. But now you watch it, you go, no, that's probably the best pure acting he'll ever do.
He is
and one of the
going
best
there.
Performances of that entire decade.
He's fantastic. I mean, first of all, that movie just was brutally slept on at the time, which we're enormous fans of that movie, and we can't wait to eventually cover it.
Yeah.
But it is
I
just
– I think it's my number two, Andrew.
It's our number two. My number one is Being John Malkovich. Number two is Magnolia
in 99. You're talking about the year.
Oh number – I was talking
Paul Thomas
PTA.
Anderson.
It's, but 99 –
I think it's my favorite.
I would say it might be my number two in 99. I can't think of anything else that would rank up – I mean it would be Malkovich and Magnolia would be two and three, and
those,
I don't know what it would be.
That was both – we did this independently of each other. And those were our one and two.
Those were our one and two. But to see what Tom Cruise does in that film – There is a level of courage for him, which is it's not something that he generally does. I don't know. I really respect the hell out of him doing Eyes Wide Shut and Magnolia in the same year.
Yeah, crazy.
You're just like, this guy really took his stardom for a spin, and it just didn't pay out in terms of awards.
He should have
won
both awards.
Well, and
I'm serious.
Yes. Best actor, best supporting actor.
I think I give it to? I think he's the guy.
I think movie stars are less precise now, which is both good and bad. I mean, I think it's better in terms of people being able to take more artistic risks. But he was like sort of the last of a model where it's like, you are the franchise.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The franchise is Tom Cruise's face and name on a poster.
Yep.
And you have to maintain that. And for someone who was that much like every Tom Cruise movie has to make $1 million off of the face alone, which he keeps doing even through like Vanilla Sky and shit.
Yeah.
Those two movies are crazy choices for him. To be like, I'm just going to hand myself over to directors who want to use me in ways where I have to give up control. And the work he's doing is very good, but he's still letting other people control the context and control what they're saying with him.
Yeah.
One of whom is 30 years old.
Yes.
Yeah. And had just only did two movies.
Yeah.
Both brilliant. Crazy about those two movies.
Yeah.
But like to give over that version of Tom to that guy. Transcendent.
Because he was a director-driven movie star. He wanted to work with top-tier people, but he'd usually match them with a piece of source material and a character that was in the Tom Cruise wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Can I get a better person to do this? Can I develop it with them? You know?
I will say that all of this – what I'm excited for is when – time catches up with Tom Cruise and he stops looking the same age. At some point he will. And he becomes a supporting actor and he stops being – and we get to see
like
him
Bridges.
Do – yeah, get to see him do weirdo shit because he does feel like a guy who when eventually he's not the hottest guy in the room, he will start to do, I think, interesting things. Maybe
there are
I'm
a
wrong.
Handful of guys like that where I just – like 10 years ago was like, oh, fuck. Can you wait until like he finally gives up the thing and becomes the character actor we always wanted to be? But you have more and more of these guys holding on to their star
looking
images
good.
For longer.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I feel the same way about Bruce Willis. Where I thought like Looper and Moonrise in the same point were like, this is the year where he's finally going to settle into deconstructing his persona and letting other directors use it and becoming the good character actor he always was.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I think he's very good in Glass.
I saw it last night.
We'll talk about it off air. The movie doesn't use him a ton, but you can tell that he's locked in.
I agree with that. You cannot say
for any other performance he's done since Moonrise and Looper.
That's very true.
Most of them go straight to Redbox, but you just get the sense that he doesn't care and that he would rather be the guy with the gun in a Redbox movie than be the interesting supporting guy in a Jeff Nichols movie.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce Willis is a guy who he's just never going to let it go.
Which is annoying because he's so good when he cares.
But I don't think Tom Cruise is going to age in the same way that Bruce Willis has aged. Like, Bruce Willis can still be the action hero, whereas the second that, like, Tom goes gray, for instance, or...
You're right, because Bruce already had the balding, and he already was kind of unconventional as an action guy. He had the weird vulnerability.
He will be Clint Eastwood. Like, he'll be the guy who's fucking... He's going to have a gun until the day he dies. I don't think Tom is the same
thing. The thing about both these guys, to me, is they both kind of reckoned with their mortality in the 90s, which Bruce Willis had accepted that he had moved on when he took on the Pulp Fiction role.
Right.
And then he fucking killed it, and it brought him right back. Same with Tom. Like, the reason Tom came back was because he was couch jumping, Scientology, all that shit.
Yeah.
Tropic Thunder. That's what brought him back into everybody's good graces, where he is playing
when he made fun of himself.
My problem with that is that, not a way I'm really going to criticize it, but I feel like the Tropic Thunder thing is so clearly, to me, a strategic move.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the Willis thing just feels like he had given up. Why not do this guy's movie? Who knows if I'm a movie star anymore? And then he's oscillating back and forth between, like, his more conventional stuff and his weirder plays and whatever. But, you know, because there's that weird... like 90s Bruce Willis, like, I want to be a comedy star wilderness with like Death Becomes Her and Bonfire of the Vanities and even Hudson Hawk and whatever. Yeah. But then, like, you go late 90s for Bruce, you have his two biggest movies ever are commercially Armageddon and Sixth Sense, where Armageddon is based on the idea that he's the old timer now, that he's not the hot young thing, which even though it's a movie that like idolizes him and sexualizes him as like this incredible like oak tree of cinema, it's still like, yeah, but he's the old fuddy-duddy now. And then Sixth Sense is M. Night going like, I'm going to bring the surface, subterranean sadness of this guy right to the level. And then Unbreakable is doubling down on like, Bruce Willis is sad. That's the thing we liked about him. There's some wounded quality in him.
Yeah,
that's the key to Die Hard, is that McClane's kind of broken and sort of miserable.
Yeah.
And it was like, that felt like early 2000s. Like, we're getting somewhere really interesting. And then, you know, he just wants to be old Clint. Like, he wants to, and not even like Unforgiven old Clint, but he wants to be doing like Tightrope or whatever,
I don't know.
Iger sanctioned. Like,
there's a lot of stuff I like about Bruce Willis, and listen, I think he's a tremendous actor. I think he is very good in Glass. I actually don't think the performances are the issue with Glass that I have, but I do wish that he'd give up the ghost a little bit and just a little bit.
And that was the thing that got me so excited, even just when the trailer for Glass came out, where I'm like, he grew the sides out and he's totally white and the beard's kind of shitty.
Yeah.
Like, he's owning the fact that he's playing the older, depressing version of his character, who was already kind of old and depressing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Griff.
What a pleasure.
Truthfully, this has been...
What can we say?
We are huge fans of the podcast. We're a huge fan of you. Yeah. This is a dream for our podcast.
I'm just glad I got to talk about this movie. So
great. This podcast started because Phil and I enjoyed Blank Check so much.
Is that true?
That is true.
That is true. So
I remember we were sitting at some restaurant.
That's so exciting to hear.
And he was talking about your run through the DreamWorks Spielberg movies.
Yeah.
And the concept of the podcast really appealed to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I haven't listened to every episode. I've listened to...
I haven't either.
Yeah. I've listened to 100 episodes of your podcast. Yeah. And we really, we love it. This has really been a pleasure
for
us.
Thank you so much for coming on.
The pleasure was all mine. I was so excited. I was so touched when I heard you had been keeping this one reserved.
We did. It was very intentionally done. I'm so glad that we were able to make it happen.
My sister's so pissed at you.
Really? Does she want to talk about this one?
I'm at PM Iskov on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Podcast Like 1999. Kenny is at Nybart. You are at Griff Lightning
on all social media platforms. Blank Checks available wherever podcasts are heard And then we have our Patreon show now, which is franchises. And please watch The Tick. I don't know when this is coming out.
It'll be in a couple weeks.
I'm not waiting to promote season two.
No.
I want people
Everyone
watching season
watch
one now.
Yeah.
I want to restate. I injured myself doing dialogue. I literally put my back into this show. I just ask that you give it a chance because
we hope that you'll come back if that's possible.
We'd be happy to. Now I'm trying to think of what I would want to
We'll
touch.
Send you the list.
Okay. Something
there's,
totally
There's
different.
About 220 films left to cover so and television and what have you. So we'd love
have
to
you
have
done
you
Galaxy Quest yet?
We've not done Galaxy Quest yet. Yeah, that could be some,
Could be our Tim Allen expert.
That's what I'm thinking. Let me corner the market.
We also haven't done Mystery Men yet.
Fuck! Oh, you're really tempting me.
but in fairness, Phil has kind of earmarked that for Dave.
I hope that Dave will come on for Mystery Men.
I think that's a get. I think you can get him.
I'm hopeful.
I'll throw it out to him.
Yeah. We're also hoping that we can get Ben Hosley on for Julian Donkey Boy.
I also think very doable. I mean, the thing with the two of them is they don't like to leave the tri-state area.
Well, we'll do it on Skype.
Sure.
But either way, thank you so much for being on. We really, really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yep.
Podcast Like It. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999.
You want a podcast like it's 1999.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.